Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, it's Francis Lamb, and this is Splendid Table Select, our baby mini podcast where we pull out the interviews that really surprised us, that showed us something new, or just made us better cooks. Splendid Table Select is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, an employee-owned company offering organic, gluten-free, stone-ground products. For decades, they've been experts at making healthy taste amazing. Learn more about Bob's Red Mill's products and how to eat wisely at bobsredmill.com. Now, let's get to this week's interview. Think about all the different places we eat. At home, outside, at our desks, in our cars. No matter where we eat, one thing remains constant. Gravity. Well, at least if you're eating on Earth. So we tracked down an expert to ask, what's it like eating in space? Colonel Chris Hadfield has flown 3 space missions, lived in space for 6 months, and served as commander of the International Space Station. Have a listen to his conversation with our contributor, Noelle Carter.
Chris, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Noelle, it's a delight. Thanks for the invitation.
You know, along with everything else you've done, you've gained worldwide acclaim for your photography, educational videos, and amazing social media posts from the space station. You've really shown the awesomeness of the everyday in space. And in one of your videos, you open a can of nuts, and the nuts look like they're literally vibrating as if they're alive. So what's it like eating in space?
You know, that was spooky when we opened that can of nuts, just because of weightlessness. It suddenly looked like it was infested with small living insects. And it was such a shock to look in that I thought, well, you know, if this surprises me and surprises Tom, I bet you it'll surprise everybody. And so we made a video. And all eating is sort of like that. You know, you can't have a bag of chips because the crumbs would go everywhere and you'd breathe them and you have to make different food choices and there's no refrigeration and no microwave. So it's a different menu, but eating in space is healthy and our dietitians work really hard. And I actually showed up back on Earth a little bit more fit, a little bit less fat, and at exactly the same weight. So it's not a bad health spa.
That's wild. I was going to say, it kind of sounds like eating in space is a little like camping.
Yes, it is. Or maybe an extended sailing trip or something where you just don't have the spare electricity and hardware to do a normal meal. The difference being, though, you can't set anything on a plate. My wife is a chef, and she constantly talks about plating things. That's a gravity thing. We end up eating like college students out of bags because you can't mix your potatoes and your gravy and your roast beef because they're all in separate containers and there's no convenient weightless way to put them all in one spot.
So I'm curious, how is food chosen for space? What kind of criteria do they look for?
You know, it's a lot driven by just how it gets there. Our delivery trucks are complex and esoteric and really infrequent. For example, if we chose to have some nice French food made by La Casse, which we did, and they manufacture it somewhere in a factory in France, but it has to meet really stringent controls. Of course, we don't want to get food poisoning. And then they package it a certain way. And then they have to ship it to NASA in Houston, who goes through, does all the quality control, packs it up for space. And then Houston needs to ship it to whatever rocket provider is going to launch it to the space station. It might be in Guyana. It might be in Japan. It might be in Russia. Wow. Or it might be in Florida. And then it gets launched to us, could be months later, and then you get it on board, and then we have to store it for who knows how long, might be a year before that particular crew gets on board.
Now, when you finally decide to eat the food, you rehydrate it, and is there any way to heat it up?
We have like a little easy bake oven up there. It just amused me when I first saw it. It's so much like an easy bake oven where it's just heated by a little heater elements, and you take your can or your little pouch of food and you put it in there and close the door on it, maybe sort of like a waffle iron kind of idea, but and just enough that it warms it up to just slightly too hot to eat so that it'll cool just a second and then you can eat it. And that works for cans and pouches of prepared stuff. And then for the dehydrated stuff, we have what looks like the little needle that you fill up a basketball with. We have one of those sort of sticking out of the wall. And you take your container, say, of, I don't know, dehydrated, even shrimp, in fact, freeze-dried dehydrated shrimp. You slide the little septum over top of that needle. You turn to the right number of ounces of water, and you push hot or cold, depending if you want hot shrimp or cold shrimp. But, of course, it's got horseradish sauce, the red sauce. It says, you know, on the package in Russian and in English, how to make your shrimp krevetki. You shake it up, you let it sit for a while, and then you have to carefully cut it open with scissors, of course, because it's in a sealed package. And then you want to open it so you don't spurt horseradish cocktail sauce all over the inside of the spaceship, because nothing falls to the floor. And then one by one, you grab the shrimp and eat them. And you think back to some shrimp fisherman somewhere who pulled those out of the sea, probably never suspecting that that little shrimp was going to end up going 5 miles a second to be eaten a few years later on board the International Space Station.
That's absolutely wild. You mentioned something about spicy foods and the senses, how your senses are affected in space. What is it about spicy foods? And is it possible to season what you eat in space?
When you're without gravity, when you're weightless on board the space station, if you think about it, there's no way for your sinuses to mechanically drain like they do on Earth. It's as if you perpetually stood on your head. So your sinuses just sort of clog up. It's as if you have a head cold forever. And everybody knows when you got a bad head cold, you just can't taste your food because your sinuses don't reflect the smells of it and your tongue's a little bit swollen. So it masks the subtle tastes of food. So you do like the spicy stuff. We have the Louisiana hot sauce and Tabasco sauce, and I really like the horseradish on the shrimp cocktail. But to try and actually mix stuff together or add condiments even pepper. You know, of course, pepper is a powder that you rely on gravity to drop onto your plate. That right. won't work. So we take olive oil and put pepper in it, sort of suspended. And when you want pepper, you sort of squirt it directly onto what you're going to eat. And we do it the same with salt. We use salt water. And you squirt your salt water on your food. That's about as complicated as we can get in our little cuisine kitchen on board.
Now, being in space, the sun rises and sets so many times in a 24-hour period while you're on the space station, and it seems like you kind of have to manufacture a day. Do you eat regular meals like we would on Earth, and is everyone on the same daily schedule?
Typically, we all live on the same daily schedule, and as you say, you have to manufacture it. We just have to decide when morning is, because we go around the world 16 times a day. So we could have chosen anybody's time zone. We found over the years it's more efficient if everybody works on the same time, and we compromised in between Mission Control in Houston and Mission Control in Moscow. So we chose just London, England. So we all get up at the same time as everybody in London at Greenwich. We get up, and breakfast is sort of on your own. You whatever you particularly like, as everyone's taking turns in the toilet. You know, it's like living in a dormitory. And then lunch is sort of on the fly as well, because everyone's period for experiments doesn't overlap properly. But supper time, dinner time, we try and definitely get together. I was the commander of the ship, and I really wanted people, for the social and the psychological benefit of it, to get together at dinner time. And typically, whoever's done their work for the day a little bit early will sing out about an hour before lunch, hey, is this okay for dinner? What do you want? You know, is this okay? And they'll start putting stuff in the little heating element device. It sort of looks like a small silver Samsonite suitcase that you squeeze your food into. Okay. And they'll rehydrate some food, and they'll lay it out on the table, and then we'll get together with as many of us as we can, and including the Russians who mostly work down in the other end of the station. We all want to share the experiences of the day and right. laugh and talk about what went on. And eating time, just like it is around a family table or for a group of friends at a restaurant, it's really important on the space station also.
That's great. So with everyone from different nationalities, do you guys all eat the same food, or does everybody bring different foods from their countries? How does that work?
Luckily, everybody brings different foods from their countries. You get to order months, years, in fact, in advance from this big list of, and we do food tasting. I sat, instead of going and feeding myself in Russia, we would sit down with their dietitians and their cooks, and they would give us a little morsel of, say, 40 or 50 different types of food that day. And you'd try it, and you'd rate it 1 to 10. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of it, you would say to them, hey, I want everything that is an 8 and above. Please give me 50% that. And then the same thing with the NASA-provided food. And then the other partners, the Japanese, the Europeans, and the Canadians, you can say maybe get a few of the top items from Japan or from Canada or from Europe. And then we get to do what are called bonus packs. And typically people will get just a nice variety so that when we're having a dinner, someone can bring out some duck confit or some some specialty food from somewhere, some canned camembert cheese or some Russian borscht or something that is really ethnic and great, and share it with everybody else. And having that variety, it's nice to have the food that gives you comfort, but it's really nice also to have the delight of something new on a regular basis.
It sounds like you guys really have a lot of variety, and it's not just about food for fuel, but food for pleasure. That said, with all the prepared stuff that you're eating, is there any food that you miss in space?
What you really miss is fresh food, stuff that has that. You miss the smell of food because nothing smells while it's cooking. And something just dripping with new flavor or a fresh salad or a good pizza or a hamburger, that type of food's impossible. And that's what you end up missing.
Are you placed on a specific diet? You know, with all the concerns about muscle and bone loss over an extended time in space, do they micromanage kind of everything that goes into your bodies?
Well, we have, of course, a team of experts on everything, including our health. And we have dietitians and chefs that work really hard to make sure that we're not getting too much salt, that we're getting a balanced, the right amount of protein. We weigh ourselves on sort of this spring device on a regular basis so that they can have a look at us. We do blood samples, urine samples. They really are interested in our long-term health. We want to keep our skeleton dense. And so, yeah, there's a lot of help and oversight to make sure that we're provided with a good diet on board. But, you know, astronauts take care of themselves also. We didn't, get to the position by having let our bodies run rampant. And so people are pretty good about self-policing. And most people come back pretty close to the target weight. And most people, I think, would come back and say the space station food is great.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. It was so much fun talking to you. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you very much, Noelle. It was really nice to talk with you again. And I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director. Chris Hadfield has orbited Earth 2,600 times and does a great rendition of David Bowie's Space Oddity. Head to splendidtable.org to watch some of Chris's wild space videos. And while you're there, check out our collection of 37 shrimp recipes to cook back on Earth. Splendid Table Selects is supported by Bob's Red Mill, and they would love to introduce you to their muesli. Created by a Swiss doctor in 1900, muesli is basically what granola wants to be. It's full of whole grains like oats, barley, and rye, and good stuff like dates, raisins, and sunflower seeds. It's a breakfast that'll make you start the day knowing you did good by yourself. And Bob's makes a bunch of versions. Gluten-free, fruit and seed, tropical, paleo, and old country style, all lower in calories and sugar than granola. It's great hot or cold. Go to bobsredmill.com to check out which muesli you'll want to try first. I'm Francis Lamb, and I'll be back with another Splendid Table Selects in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening, and eat well.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.